Hi, this is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And good morning. It's Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. KKFI would like to thank all of our listeners who tuned in this past week to hear our special live broadcast of the 17th annual Homelessness Marathon. Thank you so much. And also for those of you who joined us for our broadcast from the Folk Alliance Music Fair. We did live broadcasts on Wednesday and Sunday, and it was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it. We especially thank those volunteers, too, that made these broadcasts possible. And we hope that you'll go to the KKFI website at kkfi.org for more information about upcoming events and shows to support your appreciation. On today's edition of Jaws of Justice Radio, we're going to replay an interview with Craig Lubow, and that was conducted last September with attorney Charlotte Morrison, and she's of the Equal Justice Initiative, about how the justice system treats juveniles. And then on the second half of the show, it'll be Allie Catherine Bush, and she will be talking with Justin Burton, who is CEO and founder of Stopgap Incorporated. They're out of Lawrence, Kansas, and it's about their work with youth that age out of foster care and other at-risk youth. So check out our calendar of events. It's in the middle of the show. And then at the end of the show, we'll have the 420 drug war news. And now it's time for our interview with Craig and his guest, Charlotte Morrison, on 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. This is Craig Lubow, and my guest today is Charlotte Morrison. She's an attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, where she has litigated capital and non-capital criminal cases and civil rights cases. They work on both adult and juvenile cases. And she manages the EJI's criminal justice reform work in Alabama and coordinates their reentry program for recently released prisoners and has extensive experience working with prisoners to develop constructive reentry plans. Are you there, Charlotte?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Hi. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Let me just start out by having you go a little bit more detail about what EJI does and the scope, and if you take cases from other states or if it's just limited to Alabama.
Sure. EJI was founded in 1989 here in Montgomery, and for the first 10 years, all we did was death penalty cases in Alabama. But in 2000, we expanded the scope of our work. We wanted to address a phenomenon that was taking over the country and really affecting Alabama, in particular, this phenomenon of mass incarceration. And so we wanted to bring challenges to excessive sentences outside of the death penalty context. And that's when we began to litigate cases of life without parole sentences for nonviolent offenders, life without parole sentences for juvenile offenders. We focused on Alabama in our death penalty work because at the time we opened up our office, 25% of the country's executions were all taking place in Alabama. Yet Alabama was the only state that provided no legal assistance to people on death row who were facing execution. So there was a unique need for the work that we were doing in Alabama. Our juvenile work, we have been involved in cases all over the country. And our broader criminal docket has brought us outside of Alabama. But we do have, a particular interest in cases in Alabama because of the need here. There's no public defender, no statewide public defender in Alabama. So if you're poor and you're in prison in Alabama, you have no one to ask for help except for EJI. So we're really responsive to those requests for assistance. But a couple of our docket areas have brought us outside of Alabama. The kids that we've been representing, the people who were sentenced to life without parole as 13 and 14-year-olds, they're actually in 19 states across the country, and so we've been involved in those states. They were also people who had no lawyers, had no one paying any attention to their case. They didn't have a right to a lawyer, and so the state wasn't providing one. So we got involved in those cases as well.
Okay, and I think one of the Supreme Court cases a few years ago, maybe it's been more than a few years now, got rid of the death penalty for juveniles. Is that correct?
Yes, that was the case. The Roper case in 2005, Roper versus Simmons, the court ruled that the death penalty for juveniles was a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban against cruel and unusual punishment. That was a reversal of the court's position from 1989. In 1988, the U.S. Supreme Court held that it was unconstitutional to execute a 15-year-old. But a year later, in 1989, they said it was okay to execute a 16-year-old. And so in 2005, in the case of Roper versus Simmons, they held that it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment to execute a child under the age of 18 because of the child's unique vulnerability. They looked at things that we all know. Children are different. That's why children can't marry, they can't vote, they can't go to war, they can't decide not to go to school. And the reason why we treat them differently is because they have unique psychological vulnerabilities, and they're vulnerable to their environment, to negative influences in their environment, in a way that adults just aren't. They can't actually move. If their home environment is violent, they don't have the capacity to extricate themselves from that. They're more vulnerable to peer pressure. And all of this was actually corroborated by new advances in brain science, which showed that the brains of juveniles are extremely different from those of adults. The impulsive part, the part of the brain that leads it to impulsivity has an enormous growth during the teen years, but the executive functioning part of the brain that thinks about consequences, that restrains the impulses, doesn't actually develop until after, is not fully developed actually until the 20s. And so they looked at, you know, how the law treats children different from adults and said, in the criminal context, it would be a mistake to say that the wrongdoings of a child are the same, carry the same consequences as the wrongdoings of an adult, that we cannot say with certainty that a child is among the worst of offenders, because it's the definition of being a child is capacity for change. And so you can't say this child is beyond redemption, should be just be thrown away, because they are, by definition, capable of change.
Okay. Now, in that Roper decision, when they said you can't execute a juvenile under 18, was that based upon age of the at the time of the offense or at the time of the sentencing? So, for example, if they committed murder 2 weeks before they turn 18, would they be subject to death penalty?
No, it's the time of the offense, because what you're looking at is the culpability for that offense. And the rulings from the court have said you've got to look closely at all the factors that were present in the child's life at the time of the offense. If the child was a child at that time, you have to look at that. In 2010 and 2012, the court looked at life without parole sentences for juveniles that were mandatory. In many cases where kids have been sentenced to life without parole, the vast majority of cases, the court couldn't even consider the age of the child at the time of the offense. These are mandatory sentences. So the court is saying, you look at the age of the child at the time of the offense. One of the reasons why you look at the age at the time of the offense is, in a lot of states, kids are sitting in jails for a year or 2 years, you know, a long time before they're actually brought up for trial. And so that would be a really unfair disadvantage for a child who's a defendant in an adult case to basically have the state wait out any period where they were prohibited from seeking a certain sentence just by virtue of, you know, having waited until they turned a different age. And in that time, what the Supreme Court is saying is, in that time, the child is capable of reform, of growth. The difference between a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old is very significant. And so a child could develop significantly during that time.
Okay. But when you say they're significantly different, I think some people can grasp that if you're comparing like a 12-year-old to an 18-year-old, maybe a 15-year-old. But what do you say to people if they're having a hard time grasping that if you're comparing, let's say, a 17-year-old to an 18-year-old?
Yes, I mean, the line drawing is difficult. Under the science part of this, the brain, neurological part of this, they would actually make the line higher. And so it would be in the 20-21 range. And you see some of that reasoning reflected in our DUI and our alcohol laws. And many other laws that reflect that higher range of thinking, that you don't actually fully mature until you're older. But most laws in the United States look at that 18th birthday as a very significant birthday. And so part of this is based on the science that has developed, but part of it is based on the law as it's developed. The Eighth Amendment looks at whether a law is cruel and unusual. And so the unusual part is really based on what do we do as a country? Do we practice this often enough to make it usual or unusual? And in the case of life without parole sentences for children, it's a very unusual practice. There were only 73 13- and 14-year-olds who were sentenced to life without parole in the entire country. No other country in the world does this. No other country sentences kids under the age of 18 to life without parole. And so those are some of the things that you have to consider when you're creating case law around this. But on the difference between a 16 and 18-year-old, it is reflected in these brain scan images. You see a really extraordinary growth in the development of the brain each year, and what they liken it to is, if you look at the difference between a one-year-old and a two-year-old, you know, the growth between an infant and a toddler is enormous. And the brain, the scientists have said that the growth that you see in teen years, that growth between the infant to a toddler is only paralleled by the growth in the teen years in terms of the brain development. And I guess I would just ask anybody who's, you know, raised kids to just look at that, the growth that you see in your child as they, you know, go through high school and they can manage consequences. You know, we send our 18-year-olds off to college or off to live by themselves. We don't do that with a 16-year-old, and there are good reasons for that. They're not quite ready yet. A lot of the 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds who have been convicted of very serious offenses were involved with much older adults. And so that's another factor, is just the vulnerability to influence by others. There's an independence and an identity that you only gain as you get older, and being able to resist those pressures. It's one of the reasons why the U.S. Supreme Court said that another problem with bringing children into the adult system is children are much more vulnerable to coercive interrogation techniques. They see the officer as an authority in a way that an adult doesn't see the officer, and so they're much more vulnerable to the coercion. And we know that that there is a big problem in our criminal justice system with false confessions, and that's exacerbated in the context of children being brought into adult courts.
Okay, and these age requirements in the juvenile system, as far as sentencing, do those still apply throughout the country if the juvenile is waived to adult status?
What I'm talking about with the U.S. Supreme Court decisions only apply to adult courts, because in the juvenile context, it's a very different setting. You talk in the juvenile system, you talk about adjudications and a different sentencing structure. So what we're talking about is when a child is placed in the adult system.
Okay.
And so there are many states where there's no bottom limit for that. So we've seen 8-year-olds brought into the adult system to stand trial as an adult. Some states make the age at which you can be brought into adult court 13 years old or 14 years old, but many states have just no bottom limit to that.
And has the Supreme Court ever reviewed that issue?
No, the Supreme Court has not ruled on the age at which the age a child needs to be to be brought into adult court. That's one of the issues that we think is emerging, and it's a critical issue that we focus on, because once you're brought into adult court, if you're arrested and you're found to be appropriately moved into the adult court, you're no longer in the juvenile court's jurisdiction, so you're not placed in a juvenile facility. In many states, you're placed directly in an adult jail. We have had 14-year-old, 15-year-old clients placed in adult cells. And these are overcrowded cells where there's not enough bed space for everybody, and it's the smallest and the weakest who gets the spot on the floor, in a very vulnerable position to be in. And our clients, we've seen gone to visit 15-year-olds who've been bitten, have bite marks on their legs, they've been sexually assaulted. The risk of being sexually assaulted for a juvenile in place in an adult jail is 5 times higher than if they're placed in a juvenile setting. Suicide rate is much higher for juveniles placed in adult jails. And it's actually now a practice that's prohibited by federal policies, the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act that was unanimously passed by Congress in 2003, led to the creation of a commission that came up with best practice policies that actually are now required to receive full federal funding by the states. And one of those policies is a full sight and sound separation between juveniles and adults. In Alabama, most counties have not achieved that. Children are placed in jails with adults, directly in cells with adults, which we think is a practice that violates the Eighth Amendment.
Okay. And for those who have just joined us, we are talking to Charlotte Morrison. She's an attorney with the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, and we are talking about primarily juvenile justice. You mentioned before the Supreme Court got rid of mandatory life sentences without parole. Are there situations, though, where a court can still give life in prison?
Yes. So in 2012, in the case of Miller versus Alabama, the Supreme Court held that a mandatory sentence of life without parole for a child violates the Eighth Amendment. And all of the life without parole sentences imposed on children throughout the country were mandatory sentences. And so that's affecting all the states where they had this practice. But now the sentencing judge can consider a life without parole sentence, but they must also consider something less than life without parole. And that's what the states have been struggling with, is what is the other option besides life without parole. The Supreme Court said that it had to be a meaningful opportunity for release. And so many states have said that after you can impose a life with parole possible sentence after 10 or 20 years to be able to come up in front of the parole board for review. Some states have provided for resentencing children who are sentenced to life without parole and imposing a 25-year sentence. We represented a lot of people in Louisiana who were sentenced to life without parole for non-homicides, and that was affected by the Supreme Court's decision in 2010, the Graham decision. And these were men who had been convicted of non-homicides in Louisiana, sentenced to life without parole in the 1960s. And in some of those cases, the DA and the judge felt that they had to give that sentence. They did not want to give that sentence, and they actually appreciated the opportunity to be able to reconsider this. And so we had clients who were being released in their 60s, having spent the bulk of their life childhood in prison.
What is the trend as far as granting jury trials for juvenile offenses?
In an adult court, the juvenile defendant, the child, has a right to a jury trial. All criminal defendants in adult criminal trials have a right to a jury trial. There is the opportunity, in some cases, if the DA creates an opportunity for a plea bargain, some children and adults choose to exercise the right to enter a plea bargain as well.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the problem with coerced confessions and that being aggravated by juvenile status. What can be done or what is being done to kind of balance that and to alleviate juveniles being coerced into giving false confessions?
The priority here is to create an age barrier at which a child cannot be treated as adult, cannot be moved to the adult court. And to say that an 8-year-old could ever participate voluntarily and knowingly and intelligently in an interrogation, I think, is unreasonable and impossible. And so there really needs to be a minimum age of 15 before a child can be brought into adult court. And when you have someone under the age of 18, you know, in that range between 15 and 18, who's being brought into adult court, there need to be precautions taken. Parents have to be notified. Lawyers have to be notified before interrogation begins, so they have an opportunity to consult with their family and with an attorney before their before any contact is made between state investigators or county investigators and the child. So that would be the priority, is actually examining what is the appropriate age at which a child can be imagined to be an adult. A child is a child. They are not adults. The sort of fiction that one would have to engage in to make an 8-year-old into an adult is just unacceptable.
Okay. What have studies shown as far as the impact on juveniles of being incarcerated in adult facilities versus juveniles who are kept as juveniles in juvenile facilities?
The studies have shown that the experience of juveniles in adult settings is one of trauma. Juveniles who enter adult facilities have a very hard time protecting themselves from being subject to predatory violence. One of the most typical ways that a prison, an adult prison, manages children when they don't have a placement for children, when they don't actually have a wing for children, which most prisons don't, they end up putting the child in isolation. And we have a client who went in at the age of 13, and he spent 18 years uninterrupted in isolation. So he lived in a tiny cell and only received his food through a slot, had no interaction or contact with other people. And the studies done by the medical profession, the social science profession, have all shown that this is an extraordinarily dehumanizing and traumatizing experience that leads to extreme mental illness, and it's cruel. And so that practice, even for adults, has been shown to lead to severe mental illness and traumatization. And so for juveniles, it's only that much more severe, the experiences.
And what effect does that have on their reoffense statistics as well as their reentry to society?
The phenomenon that we see nowadays with adult prisons is one of really just warehousing. Most prisons don't provide, in Alabama anyways, don't provide rehabilitative programming. This is because of the massive overcrowding and the funding problems with the prisons. It's because of management. But the failure to give rehabilitative programming just means that we're not preparing people to come out. And that's why we have really invested in our reentry program. Studies have shown that the kind of reentry program that we provide, which is a wraparound program providing education in multiple areas in banking, technology, personal relationships, safety, and health, providing housing, providing job training, providing the kind of support one needs when you're coming out after spending decades in prison to reintegrate into society. You need relationships. Relationships with people who have judgment and can provide that sort of mentoring example that was never provided in the prison context.
Okay. Charlotte, we are out of time, and would love to talk have you on the show again on another date to talk about the reentry programs. For our listeners who just tuned in, you have been listening to Charlotte Morrison, an attorney with Equal Justice Initiative, talking about juvenile justice. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you very much.
This is Allie Catherine Bush, your guest host today on Jaws of Justice, KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. My guest today is a founder and executive director of Stopgap Incorporated. They are located in Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome this morning to Justine Burton.
Thank you.
Justine, tell us about Stopgap Incorporated and how you help children that are in the foster care program.
Stopgap Inc. is a grassroots organization that I founded in 2008. And when I founded the organization, it was to work with youth, work for youth that age out of foster care and other at-risk youth in Lawrence, Kansas. And also what I do is we have a youth empowerment outreach program that I started. Now, when I first started the organization, I had the big idea of having the transitional living program, which I found out later was a little bit more expensive. So I had to say, I said, well, these kids really need a lot of help now. So I went into the outreach program. And in our outreach program, what we do, we teach kids life skills. Some things that older people now take for granted, where they learn how to budget their money, how to do their finances, what it means to prepare for a job, and what they need to do to prepare for a job as well. Also, we teach how to find an apartment, how to read a lease, what that means, and what it means to maintain an apartment also. The program is 3 years old now, and since it started in 2012, I believe we graduated probably about, we've had about 50 kids go through the program.
Okay.
Oftentimes, the kids that we have actually aren't from Douglas County, so we get a lot of kids that come through our organization and the outreach program from different other counties in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
We get our kids from the Shelter Inc. in Lawrence, which
okay.
works with kids, and they have group home for kids. So they their kids come there, and our program is like 8 weeks program that we have for the kids.
Okay.
The kids' ages are sometimes between 12 and 17. Sometimes, and right now, I have a young lady that's getting ready to turn 18 in March, and so she's going to be aging out of the system. So these are the kids that I really, really want to help. Once they age out of the foster care system, oftentimes, you know, they couch surf with friends if they don't have any place else to go or have that family support that they need. So once they age out, they're out there 6 months to a year, usually after they age out, these kids are homeless.
Mm-hmm.
So with our outreach program being 3 years old now, my focus is on getting funding so we can start a transitional living program. And the transitional living program basically is going to be an 18 to 24 month program.
Mm-hmm.
And whereby it gives the kids, once they age out of foster care, it gives them that option to come into our program for that time.
Okay.
You know, instead of going to the street.
Okay.
It'll be something that's monitored on a 24/7 basis, so we would have somebody there. And also that the outreach program, the classes that we teach
right
there will be implemented into the transitional living program. So finding someone that has those skills and still needs to teach those skills to those kids as far as how to maintain a home and things like that. That's what the transitional living program would also entail. But with that, it would be kind of a self-regulated. We would have our own standard rules that they have to go by, but also I want the kids to have that control, still have some control of their lives. So it would be self-regulated whereby they can say, okay, I'd like to be able to do this, you know, in addition to doing that, but be able to have something that they can say, okay, this is my life, I'm in control of my life, and this is the things that I want to do. So once they leave that transitional living program, what I'm looking at is then they are able to live independently on their own. And I always say, you know, once they leave there, we're still there for them. It's not going to be, okay, you're there for 18 or 24 months and then you're out and, you know, you're out of our life.
Okay.
That's not the way this works. Okay. The way this works is that once they leave, they still have that support. Kind of a safety net, if you will.
Okay.
They still have that support. And also, and I always say, you know, once they get tired of looking at me, then I think they know what they've got what they need.
Okay.
So until that time, they can come back as much as they want to us. And, you know, if they need help with finding a job or wanting to help us interview or help them with the application process or anything like that. Be able to have that safety net so they know that there's somebody out there that cares.
Okay, now you say some of them are from out of the area. So how did they get familiar with Lawrence and what's going on there as far as them living their lives?
Yeah, and I'm not for sure. Some of them are child in need of care. And they come through probably DCF. And then, you know, I guess they go into these, you know, shelters and until they can, whatever happens to them. You know, that's usually the other section of it that I'm not that familiar with. But how they get there, I would say it was probably because of some family issues or something they had. And there were probably some of them were probably taken away from their family. Some of them might have done something wrong. You know, something like that. So that's how they get to the Shelter, Inc. And then, like I said, they send them over to us. And we don't only just take kids that are in group homes. We take kids that just need help.
Okay.
You know, if they feel that this is something they need, if a family member or parent or, you know, a foster care parent or somebody feels like this is some skills that these kids need, then by all means, you know, bring them to our organization. And like I said, it's an 8-week program, so that's something that we can help them with.
Okay. Now, I guess you are visible in the area, in Lawrence. So how do people find out about you as far as getting their children involved?
Well, usually I think it's kind of like word of mouth or something, more or less. I'm out there usually talking to people, meeting with businesses, telling them who I am. So trying to get that community awareness, and that's still kind of where I am too. You know, a lot of people know that I'm there, but, you know, sometimes they still don't know what I'm doing. And so being able to get, you know, the organization's name out there, let them know what we're doing, and be able to, you know, get that funding that we need, especially for the transitional living program. And so that's kind of what I'm focused on, really.
Okay, as far as funding, how do you stay in operation?
Well, through individual donations. Right now, that's kind of what it is. If people want to donate to the organization, they can donate to the organization. And sometimes I have this one organization that I belong to called the Optimist Club, mm-hmm. in North Lawrence, Breakfast Optimist Club. And so they started this year giving us some annual funding,
which
would help. And then where I am as far as my office and where I have my office space and stuff at, Reverend Leo Barbie, he has a church called the Victory Bible Church. Mm-hmm. And so actually he donated that space. There for a while, like, so the money was coming out of my pocket. Mm-hmm. But this is something, like I said, that I'm passionate about. And the main thing I worry about is helping the kids. But, he found out, you know, that we was looking for space and stuff, and he donated office space and a space also in his church, mm-hmm. where I conduct the outreach program as well. But as far as the funds, that's kind of where the funds are come from, is just the individual donors and stuff.
Okay, you say you teach life skills. Mm-hmm. Do you help the kids plan their education while they're at your facility?
We do as much as we can. And like I said, because these kids are in state custody, mm-hmm. you know, they do have case managers.
Oh, okay.
But what I do teach about continuing education. Mm-hmm. You know, I give them the information about, you know, how to complete a FAFSA. And also, once these kids do leave, and a lot of the kids sometimes they don't get this information, but the state of Kansas will pay for their college, 4 years of college for these kids. Mm-hmm. So, but like I said, you know, when you're young and you're homeless, you know, you're not going to find too many of them is going to sit down at a computer and try to find out which you need to go to get this information. Mm-hmm. So we try to give them this information while they're there, and give them the information of, you know, there's four-year colleges. Mm-hmm. You know, you got your two-year, and then you got your vo-tech schools as well. You know, so they at least can be able to have some kind of, know that they have a choice. You know, everybody at that point really doesn't want to go to a four-year college, and they might not be in that place mentally at that time to want to go to a four-year college. So being able to start out at a vo-tech school, then maybe move up to a junior college, mm-hmm. and then maybe if they want to continue that education, but at least show them the options that they have.
Okay, Justine, I know you mentor them in education. What about other activities, going to church or leisure time or things like that?
And that would be for the case managers to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Like I said, when you're working with with kids, especially as far as state custody, you don't want to overstep your bounds.
Right.
So I leave that part to their case managers and to the people that they're in custody with.
Okay. Do you have any volunteers that help you out?
I have a young lady now. I had a few volunteers, they all graduated from KU this year.
Okay.
So I have one young lady now that's working with me. Her name is Kaylee Koch. Mm-hmm. And she's more out in the community talking to people and trying to get in kind services and stuff for the organization. So, mm-hmm. and she's really good. I did have this one young lady that was with me for 2.5 years. Her name was Molly Shim. Mm-hmm. And she was awesome. She was really great. She graduated here in December. So she's really missed.
Okay. What are the entertainment activities that they do, leisure time, or how do they get from one place to the other? You have transportation for them?
The transportation to our outreach program is provided provided by the group home workers that work there and stuff, so they come there. But, you know, while they're in the outreach program, like I said, the skills and stuff, I make it fun for the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to make it fun for them because the information, you know, these kids are young, so the information we're trying to give is kind of boring. Mm-hmm. So we try to make it as fun as possible, and we make it more hands-on. You know, so we're not just, you know, teaching theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we make sure that like I said, if we're teaching them how to write a check, I have, you know, some copies of checks where they have to learn how to write a check, and they have to, and I teach them how to balance a checkbook. And we have this other organization that we work with. We just last Thursday, Willow Domestic Violence Center in Lawrence. And so a young lady from there, she came and had a game that you played, but the game was teaching these kids the difference between a good relationship and a bad relationship, and how to really recognize, you know, how some teenagers now, they'll, you know, they have violence in their relationships, and that's kind of what that was teaching, you know, how, what would you do, and you know, if this were to happen to you, and so, so that was a good game, and the kids really enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, that's a very important life teaching experience. Justine, let me take a quick break here to let our listeners know that have just tuned in that you are the guest today from Stop Gap Incorporated, located in Lawrence, Kansas. This is the Jaws of Justice program. I am Allie Catherine Bush on KKFI 90.1 FM. All right, Justine, let's get back to some more activities that you do. What is the vision there again for that organization?
Well, our vision is to make sure that all kids that are unable to live in a family unit will be able to flourish in life.
All right. The medical expenses, are they also through the agency? They come to you?
Yes.
Or they come to the agency?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes, and you know, I would say also that I think roughly around over 400,000 kids nationally are in the foster care system, and that's on a national basis. So then you have approximately 20,000 kids that age out of foster care each year. So on a daily level, let's say you probably got between 60 and 70 kids that age out a day in foster care.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's a troubling number of kids that don't have anybody to turn to, don't have nobody to be able to talk to, or like I said, once they become homeless, they're out there on the street, they get caught up in the sex trafficking, which is getting pretty prevalent now. You meet people that are been on the street for a while, that are seasoned, and they know when these kids are young, and they know how to talk to these kids. They know how to get these kids, draw them in. And these kids are abused physically, mentally. They wind up on drinking, you know, on drugs. And sometimes this is just basically to be able to function.
To survive.
Yeah. So, I know what these kids go through. I experienced this myself. So that's my main reason for helping these kids, because I know how it is. And when I was living on the street, it was scary then. And things are a lot scarier now than they were when I was living on the street. Matter of fact, it was right here in Kansas City, Missouri, where I lived on the street. And when you're on the street and you have no one, people treat you like they want to treat you, because they know that they don't have to answer to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these kids are beat, killed, you know, living on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, you know, nobody cares.
Yeah, so I guess that's why we have so much crime as far as drive-by shootings. And just in the last few months, all the poor children that were just victims, even in their homes.
Yeah.
So it's not just being homeless. You could be right there, and they're just not getting the proper, parental care that they need.
Right. And, that's a scary thing. And I think, you know, for these kids to be out here on the street, like I said, what is the cause? What's causing this? Mm-hmm. Is it anger? Or, what is it that they're scared of that they mm-hmm. have to go by and, you know, and kill people and take somebody else's life? You know, I can't figure that out.
Well, Justine, it has been really interesting to hear about how you're assisting, including those agencies that help you. So what we want to do this morning is to let people know how they can get in touch with you, give donations or whatever, since you don't get any government
right.
funding.
Well, thank you.
What is the location in Lawrence?
Okay, we're located at 1942 Massachusetts Street.
Okay.
And that's Lawrence, Kansas, 66044.
And you also have an email if someone wants to contact you. What is that email?
Okay, the email is stopgapinc.org@gmail.com.
Okay, and then your website, if people want to take a look and see what's going on.
Okay, our website is stopgapincorporated.org.
And your phone number?
Phone number is area code 785-856-7833.
All right. I wanted to share something with you myself about my nephew. When he was 16 years old, he came to stay with me for a while. And I tried to help as much as I could since his parents weren't available. They had health issues, so he stayed with me. After he graduated over in Kansas City, Kansas, he went to Denver, Colorado to finish his college. Mm-hmm. Met a girl there. They got married, and just a few months ago, they have a little baby girl.
Oh,
so
that's sweet.
I'm patting myself on the back that I did, you know, my share in the foster care program. So he was very successful because he knew someone cared, and I was just his aunt.
Right, and that's what these kids need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need that somebody out there, that support system, know that somebody cares,
mm-hmm.
and you. I'll pat you on your back myself, you know, because that's outstanding. I mean, that's what it's all about is mm-hmm. is making sure that you reach out to these kids because they are kids.
Okay.
And just because, you know, they don't have someone, you know, doesn't mean that they don't need mm-hmm. need that support in their life.
Yeah.
You know, everybody needs that.
Even if it is another family member, we encourage them to help also.
Right.
Please give your phone number where people can reach you.
Okay, again, it's 785-856-7833.
Okay. Justine Burton, the executive director and founder of Stop Gap Incorporated, located in Lawrence, Kansas, has been our guest this morning. Thank everyone for tuning in to Jaws of Justice. Thank you for being here.
And thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate that.
And now, the calendar for February 23rd. Reengage Incorporated and Reconciliation Ministries are again hosting the Man Class. Orientation for the March classes will be Monday, March 2nd, 10 a.m. at Reconciliation Ministries, 3101 Troost Avenue, KCMO. You must register and be on time to attend the orientation class. The MAN class is a 12-session class designed to provide you with the tools to lay the foundation for your future. If you need a change in your life, this class can help you make that change. To sign up, please contact Rodney Knott, 816-931-4751, extension 112, or by email, exec_director@reengageinc.org. That's exec_director@reengage, that's reengageinc.org. KC Move to Amend, the Economics Club of UMKC, and the Mainstream Coalition are hosting a screening of the film Pay to Play. The LA Times says Pay to Play lays out a compelling case against corporate personhood and money as free speech, researched, sourced, and interviewed exhaustively. This screening will be held Thursday, March 5th, 7 p.m. at the UMKC Student Union Theater, 5100 Cherry Street, KCMO. This event is open to the public. To contact KC Move to Amend about this event and other events they are sponsoring, call 816-885-9996 or email kcmovetoamend@gmail.com. You can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, March 2nd, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's REDROB, 2655 at yahoo.com. They ask you to bring a friend and some perishable food items for the weekend backpack program for needy children. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. Up next is Allie Catherine Bush and her guest, Justine Burton of Stopgap Incorporated.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
All right, we're here in San Francisco, California, second day of the International Cannabis Business Conference. I'm here in the atrium with Mr. Steve D'Angelo. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Dean. Nice to be here with you again.
Yes, sir. You've been the director of the Harborside Health Center for many years now and doing a little battle with the government from time to time, but you still got the doors open and doing strong, aren't you, sir?
Oh, yeah. We're going to be here for many years yet to come.
Now, I was really surprised and happy to see they were handing out brochures downstairs in the ballroom, and lo and behold, they handed me one that says The Cannabis Manifesto, A New Paradigm for Wellness, and it's written by Mr. Steve D'Angelo. Tell us what's in that book, Steve.
So The Cannabis Manifesto is 8 chapters. Each one is a statement of belief, starting with cannabis isn't harmful, but prohibition is. Then we move on with 7 other core foundational arguments about cannabis, and I back those arguments up with history, science, political analysis, and personal anecdotes. So my personal story is sort of woven throughout the arguments of the book.
Steve, in my work, I try to get, you know, top government officials to come on my show to clarify the need for drug war, to explain why this is all so necessary. And lately they've been really recalcitrant, running like frightened rabbits, because there is no real defense to what they're up to, is there, Steve?
No, it's totally clear if you just look at the statistics that the drug war has been a disaster. It's caused far more harm than any possible good that could come of it. Upwards of 80% of the arrests in the drug war actually have been for cannabis, not for cocaine, heroin, meth, or other dangerous drugs. So the drug war has mainly been a war on cannabis.
Yeah, and Steve, over the years, I've heard $1 trillion. I've heard, I think it was Judge James P. Gray said $2.5 or $3 trillion have been, quote, invested into enforcing these drug laws. We haven't rid ourselves of drugs at all, have we?
Well, no. In fact, you know, all of the quote-unquote investment into the war on drugs has directly led to the development of some of the most powerful criminal organizations on the planet. They now have basically prohibition acts as a price support system for the cartels and puts hundreds of billions of dollars into their hands every year. If the U.S. government was really serious about breaking the backs of the cartels, the very first thing that they would do would legalize cannabis, because the cartels get something like 70% of their revenue from cannabis.
More from Steve D'Angelo on the most recent cultural baggage. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? 1, 2, 3. Here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
Keep that smile on my face. Go teach my